Hello, my friends. It's Monday, April 14th, 2025, and I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, your Red State refugee, and welcome to the Radical Russ Show, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in my undisclosed mountain hideaway in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon. We've got another fantastic show for you as I get myself ready to do my taxes. Oh my God, it's April 14th. It's coming up on tax day tomorrow, folks. I sure hope you got everything ready, since it appears nobody's going to call for a tax revolt against this criminal maladministration. And Lord knows I'm not going to be the only one getting hauled up in front of the IRS for some sort of MAGA audit. So here we go. It's tax day. Hey, on the show today, all sorts of things to cover. First of all, the Department of Justice completely ignoring a 9-0 Supreme Court ruling on facilitating the release of Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. We saw Stephen Miller was all over Fox News telling lies about his abduction and the need to return him to our country. We'll also take a look at the horrific attack on Governor Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania. The arson attack and a planned hammer attack is coming out now in the reporting on this story. We'll get you all caught up. Then we'll talk about the rise of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as she barnstorms the country with Bernie Sanders, bringing out crowds in Los Angeles and yesterday, Utah. And I understand today they will be in my original home state of Idaho. And while AOC is rising, one political career completely flamed out, and that's Big Gretch. Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, caught herself in a terrible example of how everything Trump touches dies. And speaking of death, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., our head of Health and Human Services, wants us all dead. We'll tell you about his latest policy proposals, as well as a look at the Department of State, where Secretary of State Marco Rubio is rooting out anti-Christian bias in our government. Interesting. Then some local news coming here out of Grants Pass in Josephine County, Oregon, how they've been impacted by the Doge Boys. And in our regular Boycott Idaho segment, we unfortunately have to bring you the news of the death of Victor Perez, the young autistic boy who was gunned down by a firing squad of cops from behind a chain link fence. We've also got some other Idaho stories on loosening their abortion ban and how they want to start their own Doge task force in Idaho. I have some suggestions as to where they could cut some funds. Then in our radical rant, I am desperately seeking 3 consecutive Democratic presidential terms. And while I'm talking, think about that. When was the last time you saw 3 consecutive Democratic presidential terms? All that is coming up on the Radical Rush Show. But before we get to that stuff, just a couple little things. First of all, I saw that Orange Cheeto Mussolini had his annual physical, and the doctor has reported that Donald Trump is 6'3", 224 pounds. (laughs) 6'3", 224. You know who else was 6'3", 224 pounds on October 1st, 1975? Muhammad Ali. The greatest. When he fought Joe Frazier in the Thrilla in Manila, the tale of the tape was that he was 6'3", 224 and a half pounds. You expect me to believe that big fat tub of lard leaning over in his lifts is 6'3", 224? You want me to believe Donald Trump is in the same physical shape as Muhammad Ali in his prime, the greatest? Give me a break. And one other quick break I need. I saw that... the big penis launched into space, the Blue Origin rocket ship of Jeff Bezos, the Amazon centibillionaire, who sent 6 women into space, including his girlfriend, Lauren Sanchez, Oprah's best friend, Gayle King, and singer Katy Perry, who I anticipate was just trying to get as far away from Russell Brand as possible. Yay! We sent a bunch of women up into space for an 11-minute joyride. Whoopee! Gee, can we tax Jeff Bezos now? Can we tax some of these billionaires now? They got enough money to just be throwing joyrides for their girlfriends up into space, but we can't bother to get them taxed. I'll tell you, if anybody associated with Jeff Bezos is doing some good with their money, it's Jeff Bezos' ex-wife. She's doing some wonderful work. As you know from our show on Friday, the United States Supreme Court decided 9-0 that Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia, who was renditioned to our concentration camp in El Salvador, which the government itself has admitted was a mistake, they ruled 9-0 that the government needs to facilitate the release of Garcia from the prison and remanded the case back to the lower courts to determine how that was going to happen. And since then, the Department of Justice has been doing stalling and delay tactics, various responses to the court that are lacking in any detail. Just, it's like a little kid who's been caught and been grounded and, you didn't say that I couldn't use my phone. Oh, but you didn't say this or, but I didn't do. It's all just the government dragging their feet in what I believe is either an attempt to cover up the fact that Garcia is already dead in that prison, or that they want to wait long enough to make sure that he will be. The government, in a couple of their filings, said that Armando is alive and being held in the prison in El Salvador. We just have to take their word for that. And the president of El Salvador, Bukele, is coming to the White House today. We'll see if the White House press corps has any spine left to be able to ask some tough questions as to why that man is being held incommunicado and without rights in our concentration camp. Stephen Miller was on Fox News trying to defend it, saying up is down and left is right, that the 9-0 decision was actually a decision in favor of the Department of Justice, saying that the 9-0 decision illustrates that nobody can tell President Trump what to do when it comes to his Article 2 powers, and continuing to say that Abrego Garcia was an El Salvadorian man who was set to be deported, and the only reason that there was a decision saying that he wasn't to be deported was because of some Democrat activist judge in the immigration ranks who's since been relieved of duty, and that if we were to try to get Abrego Garcia out of the prison, why, that would be going against the sovereignty of El Salvador and kidnapping an El Salvadorian citizen right from underneath El Salvador. How could we do that to an ally? How could we do that to someone who's got their own sovereignty? It would be an act of war. Give me a break. Why is it that somehow Joe Biden was able to secure the release of lots of prisoners from Russia, a country we don't have agreements with, a country we are enemies of? How is it that Joe Biden was able to secure the release of a bunch of Americans, but somehow Donald Trump can't get one guy out from a country with whom we have contracts, with whom we are paying to keep these people down in our torture gulag, in our work prison, in our death camp there in El Salvador? And, you know, something gets lost in all of this, too. We talk about Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia being down there because he's completely innocent, even though Stephen Miller keeps asserting he's a member of the dreaded MS-13, which, again, I don't recall us having any declaration of war against these street gangs. This is all coming under the generalized heading of terrorism. You remember way back in the early 2000s when the USA Patriot Act was getting passed and we were declaring the authorization of use of military force and we were saying we're having this war on terror all across the globe. Remember us all saying back then what a terrible idea that was to put such open-ended terms in our authorizations of force? And yet these authorizations of force kept getting renewed by the George W. Bush administration, and then the Barack Obama administration, and then the Trump administration, and then the Biden administration, because, oh, we got to keep that war on terror going. Yeah, it's kind of coming back to bite us now, isn't it? Because now Trump can just say, oh, well, they're terrorists. MS-13, they're terrorists. Tren de Aragua, they're terrorists, and we've got this authorization of force, and we hate terror, and so therefore it's all justified. And as I was beginning to say, one of the things that gets lost in all of this discussion is the fact of Garcia being an innocent man completely wrongly detained, wrongly imprisoned, wrongly renditioned. What gets lost in all this is that none of the people that we have sent to El Salvador should be there, even the guiltiest ones. Even if they are MS-13 Tren de Aragua, even if they're the worst, most heinous killers, murderers, rapists out there, they still have rights. They still get due process. That's what America is all about. That we don't have kings that just declare someone's an enemy of the state with no evidence, no hearing, no chance to defend themselves. So yes, let's bring back Kilmore Abrego Garcia, but let's bring back all of them. What crazy looking glass have we stepped through where the United States of America grabs people off the streets with no warrants, no probable cause, no due process, and ships them to an overseas gulag where our courts have no jurisdiction? This is the constitutional crisis, folks. This is it right here. This is Trump daring the rest of the United States, all of its guardrails, all of its institutions, to say, make me. I'm going to take people off the streets. I'm going to send them to prison camps where they will die with no representation, no way to get in touch with their families. I will do it to anyone I choose. I don't care if they're an immigrant or not, citizen or not. I can do this. And you think you can stop me? Well, make me. That has been Trump's operating procedure for his entire life, has been fuck you, make me. You can't do that. It's fraud. Fuck you, make me. You can't do that. It's illegal. Fuck you, make me. You can't do that. It's an insurrection. Fuck you, make me. So right now, the Supreme Court has 9-0 said make them. And the lower courts, Judge Zenas there, still going back and forth with DOJ, who are completely negotiating in bad faith. Every document that they put forth to that court is a lie or a delay tactic. Someone needs to go into a jail cell. We are long past the point where someone should have been put in contempt of court and the bailiff remand them to custody immediately. People need to start going to jail. People need to start feeling handcuffs. And you know, situation reverse, Democrats in charge. This would have happened by now. Somebody would have been, from a Democratic administration, held in contempt, locked into jail. These kid gloves that we use for some reason in our politics, especially when it comes to conservatives, need to come off. It's time to start playing some hardball, start locking some people up, start fining some people, make them feel the effects of this. And the other thing that frustrates me about this is just the open corruption and lawlessness that's going on. And nobody can do a thing because someone wrote a memo back in the Nixon administration, a memo, not a law, not an executive order, not a regulation, a memo that says we can't criminally indict a sitting president because it would interfere with their constitutional duties. Well, what if a president has no care for his constitutional duties? What if everything he's doing is counter to the Constitution? How could indicting him and arresting him interfere with him performing his constitutional duties when he has clearly abrogated his constitutional duties? A memo. We can't arrest Donald Trump for a memo. A memo written over 50 years ago. Literally, Donald Trump could walk out of the White House with a gold-plated, because you know it'd be gold-plated, a gold-plated AR-15 and loads of ammo. And he could walk right into the House of Representatives while they're in session and start spraying bullets, gunning down everyone he sees. And the Department of Justice couldn't indict him because, you know, in 1973, they wrote a memo. We can't indict him for mass murder. Well, they wrote a memo back in 1973. I suppose maybe Washington, D.C. could arrest him. Or, you know, committing murder. But at what point does that become then a battle between the Secret Service and the D.C. police? A memo from 1973 is allowing all of this to continue. There was terrible news this weekend coming out of Pennsylvania, where the governor's mansion was set ablaze. An arsonist broke into the governor's mansion while Governor Shapiro, his wife, and kids were asleep. Broke into the mansion, set a fire, and the security forces were able to catch the guy and knock on the door of the governor's mansion to alert Shapiro and his family so they could get out of there. The news coming out now is that the guy they caught is a total MAGA. Surprise! Guy's a total MAGA, and that part of his plans were that in addition to setting fire to the house, that if he had come upon Governor Shapiro there in the mansion, he was going to attack the governor with a hammer. Does that sound familiar? Oh, yeah. Remember when Nancy Pelosi's house was invaded by a MAGA, who then used a hammer to beat the hell out of her husband, Paul? And then remember how all the MAGAs and Donald Trump laughed about it and made jokes about it? Ha, ha, ha. This is stochastic terrorism. This is where Donald Trump puts it out there in the ether. Who will rid me of this meddlesome priest? Who will deal with the terrible Democrats out there? Who will bring them down? He puts it out there in the ether. He dehumanizes his opponents and laughs to encourage violence against them. Treats it as a joke. And no surprise, some of these crazy fuckers take him up on it. And here we have it in Pennsylvania. Now, given that this is Josh Shapiro, an elected governor of a state who is Jewish, one of the highest ranking Jewish elected officials in the United States, and given that this was taking place on the first day of Passover, major Jewish holiday, well, you know that MAGA's got to be all over this, right? Because they despise anti-Semitism. Oh, they despise anti-Semitism. So, you know, if you're out there protesting for Palestinians, oh, you're so anti-Semitic. Oh, we got to revoke your visa. We got to deport you. We got to send you off to ICE concentration camp somewhere. Because, oh, you're so anti-Semitic, you're harassing Jewish kids, even though a lot of the Jewish kids are also protesting the Gaza stuff. But, yeah, that's anti-Semitism, because we've seen MAGA come down on anti-Semitism. Oh, you can't be anti-Semitic. Oh, we're going to deport you. So you know they had to be right front and center on this attack on Governor Shapiro's house, right? Let's check Donald Trump over there at the Truth Toilet. And scroll through here. Scroll. Let's see what we got in here. Scroll. Yeah, Sunday. He's going off on 60 Minutes. Crooked Joe Biden. Zelensky and Biden's fault that Russia invaded Ukraine. Nope. Not a thing. Not a goddamn thing about Governor Shapiro. Not a word from Donald Trump in the White House about an anti-Semitic attack and a potential assassination attempt. And that's really what we need to be framing this as. I mean, my God, if Donald Trump can be victim of an assassination attempt from some guy hanging out on his golf course that never even got close to him, then this is an assassination attempt when they try to burn down the home of the governor and plan to bash his skull in with a hammer. But nope, not a word from Trump on this. Not a word from Trump on Elon Musk and a bunch of other of these MAGA people doing Sieg Heils in public. Nope, that's not anti-Semitic enough, apparently. Having dinner with Nick Fuentes, a known anti-Semite, that doesn't raise their ire a bit. Not a bit. Protesting Gaza, though, that's that's sure anti-Semitic. And boy, has there been a reaction from our Department of Justice yet? Pam Bondi gonna declare this an act of terrorism? Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Nobody spray painted a dick on a Cybertruck, so I guess it's not really terrorism, is it? One of the things that's giving me hope these days is seeing the remarkable videos coming out from the Fight Oligarchy Tour being put on by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. A lot of people talking about this. They're drawing massive crowds. This weekend, they drew 36,000 people in Los Angeles, which both AOC and Bernie say are the largest crowds they've ever spoken to, the largest rally crowds they've ever had. They even drew 20,000 people at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, and they're going to Idaho today, where I'm sure they'll also draw out a huge crowd. And one thing this is proving is that there is no room for bipartisanship these days. There is no audience for bipartisanship. People want a fight. People want to fight for what they believe in. And the MAGA side, the Tea Party side, have known this since about 2010. They've gone all in on being ultra-conservative dickbags. So it's time on the left that we go all in as well and forget about trying to work with our colleagues across the aisle, with our friends from the other side. There are none anymore. This is a cold civil war. We have long been in a cold civil war, and it's about time that the left wake up to this. And I believe this Fighting Oligarchy Tour is the beginning of this. And some people, you know, poo-poo this. It's like, oh,
if you just have a bunch of rallies and then you don't do follow-up actions like getting voter registration cards and
lay off it, man. As if we don't have a guy in the Oval Office right now who did nothing but run rallies for the past 10 years, even when he wasn't running, even when there was no campaign, even when it was looking like he would never return to elected office again, he was out there doing rallies because he understands that people have to have something to rally behind, something to be a part of. That's what's been so successful about MAGA is it makes people feel like they're a part of something. There's a story being told that America is in decline. It's been taken over by the forces of wokeness and DEI that's going to ruin everything and make your white kids feel guilty and elevate black people above you. And the world's falling apart and there's no place for white people anymore. But you can get behind MAGA and join us and we'll fight back and make America great again like it used to be when everything was white and delightsome. It gives people something to be a part of, a team to join, a cause for fighting. And that's what this Fight Oligarchy Tour is doing, is it's recognizing the enemy, the oligarchy, the 1%. And it's building a coalition of people that can include the blue-haired soccer mom, as well as the red-capped guy in the F-150 whose business is about to go under because of tariffs. This is brilliant politics. And it seems to me the people that are poo-pooing it are the same type of democratic neoliberal strategists that managed to lose two elections to a reality TV star. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the radical rant about the Democrats' inability to string together three successive terms. So AOC is out there doing these rallies, and not only is she speaking, but at all of these different locations, she's got others in the state or the local government that are coming up and speaking as well, which, again, helps to build the team, helps to make us feel like, even at the most basic level, our municipal level, that we can be a part of that team at the city level that's working with the team at the state level, that's working with the team at the national level, that there's a through line to all of this. And there are some wonderful speakers, but I want to give you a couple here. First, these are from the Los Angeles appearance, and they were broadcast on the Midas Touch Network, which, by the way, has outstripped Joe Rogan as the number one podcast out there, rapidly growing liberal podcast network. Love them. Maybe they'll call me up one day. I'd love to work for Midas Touch. Anyway, talking about local speakers, here is a local District 1 council member from Los Angeles, council member Eunice Hernandez, speaking at the Fight Oligarchy rally.
Helicopter, but not for senior meals or streetlights. Why is there always money for jails, but not after school programs? Why is there always money to bomb children in Gaza, but not enough to make sure every kid has a safe place to sleep in this country? We don't have a budget crisis. We have a crisis of our values. And if we are serious about fighting fascism, we have to dismantle the systems that uphold it. Because budgets are not neutral. Budgets are blueprints for the world we are building. They're a statement of our values. And most importantly, it's your money. It's your money. And we deserve better. And according to some people, that makes me and you radical. But it's not radical to say one job should be enough. It's not radical to say people who work here should be able to afford to live here too. It's not radical to say we deserve clean air, clean water, clean food.
She's right. You know what's radical is if you have $1 billion and then you say, you know what, I need another billion. I need another $1 billion. And then saying, you know what's radical after that is saying, you know, I need another $10 billion. And you know what's radical is then saying, I need another $100 billion. While people go without food, while people live in the streets, while our veterans are shivering underneath a bridge somewhere, what's radical is sending six of your girlfriend and six of her friends, five of her friends, up into a rocket ship for a joyride while people are in need. And I love how she pointed out how there's always enough money for bombs for Gaza as well. Because if you ask me, one of the critical mistakes Kamala Harris' campaign made was not distancing herself from Joe Biden and the support of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. People are starting to recognize the propaganda that has always portrayed the United States and Israel as the good guys is just that, propaganda. There was another person who spoke out. This is Representative Jimmy Gomez, congressman from California's 34th district, a colleague of AOC's.
They got a simple plan: defund, defraud, and lie. They're going to defund Social Security, defund Medicaid, defund education, defund science, defund anything that helps the man and woman who's trying to get by to put food on the table or to pay rent. And then they're going to lie about it, all while giving tax breaks to their billionaire friends at the cost of the working class. They are robbing this country in broad daylight, and they're counting on us to stay quiet. Are we going to stay quiet? Are we going to stay quiet? Are we going to stay quiet? Hell motherfucking no.
All right, Jimmy, settle down just a little bit. First of all, if you're not Samuel L. Jackson, please don't try to make motherfucking work in the middle of another curse. What? Hell motherfucking no. Just hell no would have sufficed, Jimmy. That'd be just fine. But I do like him bringing up they want to defund Medicare, defund Social Security, defund education. Because what was one of the big calls that was thrown up in the Democrats' face over the last few elections was defund the police. When activists were talking about defund that the police, that was seen as heresy. How dare you say defund, get rid of the police? How dare you? So let's use that kind of language. Defund education, defund Social Security, defund Medicare. Make them have to stand by the word defund. And of course, the closer, the big ticket, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, making the call and almost calling someone out by name.
And we saw this play out this week with Trump's corrupt and disastrous tariff scheme. I hope that we all see now that the White House's tariff shuffle here didn't have anything to do with manufacturing like they claimed. It was about manipulating the markets. It was about hurting retirees and everyday people in the sell-off so Trump could quietly enrich his friends who he nudged to buy the dip before reversing it all in the morning. Donald Trump is a criminal. A criminal found guilty of 34 felony counts of fraud. Of course, he is lying and manipulating the stock market too. He is at his best making himself, the billionaires who back him, and the members of Congress who trade with him rich. Not you, not me, not the people. And to be clear, I don't care what party you are, Democrat or Republican. I don't care what position one holds. Members of Congress and elected officials holding and trading individual stock is wrong. It must end, and we must ban it.
Oh, yeah. Music to my ears. No matter which party, Democrat or Republican, no matter which position of power, like Speaker Emerita, you hold, you should not be trading stocks when you are serving in Congress. The level of corruption that this has gone on for so long and has just been accepted by both sides. Now, I've heard some discussions about this. I actually was listening to a podcast the other day. Scott Galloway was on discussing this very topic, and he gave one solution that I hadn't really considered that actually makes a lot of sense. And his thought was, pay them more. The members of Congress are making something like $174,000 a year, $190,000 if you're like in leadership or something like that, but under $200,000 a year. Now, $200,000 a year would last me for about 5 years. I can do quite well on that, and I suppose a lot of you could as well. But when we're talking about being a member of Congress and having to live part-time in D.C. and fly back to your home, you still got to maintain your home back home and all the bills associated with that. But then you get your bills associated with being in D.C. And a lot of the people that go into these positions, representatives, aren't all bartenders like AOC was. Some of them are lawyers, physicians, people that work in high-level professional jobs where they could make more money than under $200,000 a year. So Galloway's proposal was pay these guys $1 million a year. Make them all millionaires. I mean, the ones who aren't already millionaires. But pay them. And then when you do pay them $1 million a year, make sure corruption is absolutely forbidden. It's like no stock trading, no gifts, none of that stuff. Absolutely forbidden. But we'll pay you enough money, $1 million a year, that you don't feel the need to have to do the grift. And there doesn't have to be a revolving door where the representative or senator, you know, is only making $200,000 and then they get out to make millions as a lobbyist. Take that incentive away by paying them more. It's interesting. I like the thought, and maybe we should try it. Now, on the opposite side of AOC and Bernie Sanders, who are rising in politics by emphasizing that this is a partisan battle, that we need to pick sides. You can be on the side of the oligarchy or you can be on the side of the people. A couple of folks have gone the other direction, most notably Gretchen Whitmer. Oh, poor big Gretch. Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, has been touted as being a rising star in Democratic politics and a potential contender for a 2028 presidential nomination, but I don't think so anymore. Whitmer talked herself into going to the Oval Office at Trump's invite for discussion of something having to do with manufacturing and tariffs. And Michigan, it is a tough kind of gig talking about tariffs because, yes, Trump's tariffs are crazy and way too much and way too broad. But in Michigan, and when it comes to, you know, auto manufacturing and such, there are some places where targeted tariffs are useful. You know, tariffing some of the foreign cars and foreign parts to try to boost the fortunes of the domestic car manufacturers. So maybe Whitmer thought she could walk this tightrope, get in there and talk with Trump, appear to be bipartisan, maybe try to win over some of those more rural MAGA type counties in Michigan swinging her way by showing she's willing to work with Trump and the tariffs can be good if we do them in the right way. And unfortunately, she did not heed the lesson that was first put forth by Rick Wilson, and that is everything Trump touches dies. Everything Trump touches dies. He is the reversed King Midas. Everything he touches turns to shit. Happened to the LA Dodgers. They went to the Oval Office to celebrate, you know, their World Series victory from last year. And after that visit, they went into a major slump, like lost 12 out of 13 games or something like that. Everything Trump touches dies. And so Trump gets Whitmer in there to the Oval Office, which, by the way, if you haven't seen pictures of the Oval Office these days, my God, it's like Goldmember threw up in there. Everything's gilded in gold. There's all this gold filigree and gold leaf and gold frames on the portraits. And it's just embarrassing, just gaudy as hell. So she's here in this gold room, the golden Oval Office with Trump. And he starts doing other stuff that she had no idea was coming. Starts signing all these executive orders for this and that, all these embarrassing things that she is now stuck in this room with all the photographers taking pictures that she knows are going to be captioned. Gretchen Whitmer observes as Donald Trump signs the executive order declaring Elmo a terrorist, or, you know, whatever the hell the executive's orders were, right? Declaring that Sesame Street shall be, you know, blown up. Puppies and orphans shall be murdered at midnight. Whatever the executive orders were. Whatever it was, terribly embarrassing to Gretchen Whitmer. And there's a photo now, and this one is going, this is her political epitaph, folks. If you haven't seen the photo, go seek it out. It's Gretchen Whitmer standing against the wall with all the gold filigree around her in her blue pantsuit or whatever it is she's wearing. And then she's got some blue binders or folders, and she's literally hiding behind them. She's got them over her face, covering her head. Please don't take pictures of me. Please don't see me. And that will be the most enduring image of Gretchen Whitmer hiding her embarrassment from being there working with Trump. And another person who ought to be embarrassed, but I'm sure has no capacity for shame anymore, is Bill Maher. Man, what? Bill Maher who's the other cat I used to really like? On SNL, I can't remember his name. Dennis Miller, there we go. Bill Maher and Dennis Miller, two comedians who, when I was much younger, found them incredibly hilarious. And as they have gotten older, have really lost it, really gone off the conservative deep end. Maher, of course, made the pilgrimage with Kid Rock, his new buddy Kid Rock, to the White House to have dinner with Trump, and I think it was Dana White and some other folks coming out there spewing out, oh, well, Trump, you know, he plays this guy on TV who's all crazy and blustery, but, you know, in private, he's a really nice guy. He's really sweet. He's really endearing. He's not the crazy guy. Oh, but this Trump guy. Bill. First of all, of course, Trump is gracious and kind and wonderful in person. He's a narcissist. That's what they do. That's how they work. When they want something from you, they are the most wonderful, charismatic, beautiful people in the world. You can't believe how swell they are when they want something from you. It's called love bombing, Bill. Open a book. But you know why Bill's there. Bill's there because for years and years and years, he's been goading Trump. He actually was sued by Trump, I think it was for $5 million, because Bill Maher stated that Trump was the son of an orangutan, that one of his parents was an orangutan. And so Trump sued over that. And of course, the suit was dismissed because it's a joke, right? But, you know, Maher's got to be quaking in his boots now, seeing people being disappeared to El Salvador and work camps. And gosh, he must be thinking, you know, maybe if I'm just nice, maybe if I kiss up enough, maybe he won't throw me in the gulag. That, and he's now, you know, on CNN so regularly, and CNN has banked so far to the right, trying to kiss the ring to make sure they, too, aren't hit by any sort of sanctions by the fascist regime. So, Bill Maher, Big Gretch, you have learned the lesson. Everything Trump touches dies, and you've proven, by counterpoint, that there is no appetite for bipartisanship. AOC and Bernie are drawing massive crowds because they are ready to fight this battle. You all are losing your careers because you wanted to appease the dictator. I saw a funny meme run through social media that was a discussion between a person and the pronatalist. You know, these pronatalist people who say we need to have more babies. There's just not enough babies. Of course, what they mean is there's not enough white babies because there's plenty of babies. But anyway, the imagined discussion goes like this. The pronatalist says, we need you to have more children. You need to have 8 to 10 children. And the response is, well, 8 to 10 kids, what is it, like the old days when you had to have so many kids because half of them lived through puberty because of lack of basic sanitation and vaccination? Is that why? And the pronatalist responds, hey, funny you should mention that. Yeah, because that's what Make America Healthy Again is leading us to under the direction of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Fuckwit Kennedy Jr., who says, you know, someone who's healthy, they don't have much problem dying from any of these diseases. Which is absolute bullshit. Kennedy is out here telling people that the problem with people dying from the flu and pneumonia and all these other things people die from is because they're leading an unhealthy lifestyle because of obesity and lack of exercise and poor nutrition. Why, if you just got good nutrition and exercised, you'd never get sick at all, which is absolute horseshit. My goodness. Healthy people drop dead all the time. Healthy people get diseases all the time. That's why we have, you know, these athletes who go on injured reserve sometimes because they get sick. They get the flu. Michael Jordan famously played a flu game in the NBA Finals. Having to have IV fluids pumped into him. If Michael Jordan's not in good enough shape to not get sick, I don't think the rest of us have much of a chance. But RFK, he wants to see us all dead. He wants to return us, make America healthy again. Let's go back to the Oregon Trail days where you have died of dysentery. Yes, he's arguing for warnings now to be put out by the CDC to say that there are risks from vaccines and they shouldn't be mandatory, despite the science that has shown that vaccines are incredibly safe, especially compared with just about any other sort of pharmaceutical regimen you might put yourself onto. They're incredibly safe and have saved millions of lives. We eradicated, or at least for a time, we eradicated measles, polio, some of these other deadly childhood diseases. But if we're not going to have vaccinations, if we're going to kill all the vaccinations out there and reduce the herd immunity and have measles and rubella and all these terrible diseases circulating through the populations again, then yeah, I guess we do need to have 8 or 10 kids for the 5 or 6 that are going to drop dead. That's the world he wants to take us back to. He also made the announcement that by September,
we will be researching the causes of autism, and by September we'll know what the causes are and work to eradicate them.
Yeah, like I said, RFK always sounds like he's holding in a hit, doesn't he? So yeah, he is saying he'll know the cause of autism by September, because that's how science works, right? We need to find the grand unified theory of quantum mechanics and general relativity, and we need to have it by September, because that's how science works. Yeah, RFK Jr. saying there's going to be a cause for autism determined by September means he already knows what he thinks the cause is, and that is vaccines. And so by September, we're going to get some sort of announcement that repeats the quack junk science of vaccines and autism that has been disproven so many times that researchers are getting tired of asking to disprove it. The other thing that Kennedy wants to get rid of, fluoridated water. He's working to end the mandates of fluoridated water. And we already have cities and states. The state of Utah has already backed out of fluoridating their water. And again, the studies on this are clear. We are talking about 0.7 parts per million fluoride in the water. 0.7 per million. which is like 2 inches and 16 miles. That's the type of ratio we're talking about when you talk about 0.7 versus a million. There is absolutely no way you could drink enough water for the fluoride in that water to cause any sort of adverse health effects. Something like 435 gallons you'd have to drink before you'd even start to get a harmful amount of fluoride. And all the studies show a drastic reduction in cavities for the kids in these places that have fluoridated the water, and stronger teeth. So, of course, we got to get rid of that because of, again, the way it works in these Maha people's minds. This is the sickness they're living under, the mental sickness. They're in that fallacy that natural means good. They believe, oh, everything natural is good and anything artificial is bad. Anything made by nature is good. Anything made by science is suspect. You know, everything in nature is good, like nightshade, belladonna, you know, a couple plants that if you eat them, you will die. But they're natural. This is the flawed thinking that so many of these anti-vax, pro-nature people have. Because when it comes to chemicals, molecules, substances, they are neither good nor bad. Heroin is neither good nor bad. Fentanyl is neither good nor bad. Your relationship with it can be troubled, but the object itself is neither good nor bad. It is a tool. Fentanyl, misused, taken unknowingly in a snort of cocaine or something like that, can kill you from overdose. But there are plenty of people out there who are taking prescribed fentanyl to deal with massive chronic pain. So for the former, the coke snorter, fentanyl's a bad thing. For the pain patient, fentanyl's a good thing. So it's neither good nor bad that we're artificially putting fluoride in the water. Just because it's artificial doesn't make it bad. The molecule itself, fluoride, in the amounts it's given, is a good thing. One thing we know for certain that is a bad thing, though, real bad, even in parts per million levels, lead. Lead is really bad. Lead poisoning leads to lower IQs among children, leads to all sorts of problems with development. Lead is really bad. We don't want lead. But lead is natural, isn't it? And that must be why RFK Jr. has ordered the dismantling of the CDC's lead program. This is the program that helps to ameliorate lead paint in the walls, lead in various environmental factors, in schools. Lead that is harming children to this day. RFK has dismantled the task force that deals with that. So, no fluoride in your kids' water, but there might be lead in the pipes that brings the water to your kids. This government is actively trying to kill us. Now, looking at another arm of the government, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who I will never fail to remind you was approved 99-0 by the U.S. Senate. Every single Democrat voted for Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio is now dedicating the Department of State to rooting out anti-Christian bias. We're going to seek out anti-Christian bias. We're going to root it out. Anti-Christian bias. Not a word about Islamophobia. Apparently, there's not a problem with Islamophobia in the government or anti-Semitism. I know other people have been talking about the anti-Semitism, but apparently that's not the issue for Rubio. It's this anti-Christian bias. People are so biased against Christians. Oh my God, the anti-Christian bias in America, where we have their God on the money and their savior has his own holiday. Oh, the bias. Oh, the bias against Christians. Which opens up a whole set of problems, right? Because there's a lot of different flavors of Christians out there. Like, if I were to go out and say, anyone who worships the Sabbath on a day other than Saturday is a heretic, Is that anti-Christian bias? Because most Christians worship on the Sabbath on the Sunday, don't they? Ah, but not the Jehovah's Witnesses. They're all about the Saturday. What if we were to say that anyone who says the Pledge of Allegiance or sings the national anthem is a heretic, is anti-God? Is that an anti-Christian bias? Well, again, those Seventh-day Adventists, they don't do the Pledge of Allegiance. They don't celebrate birthdays even. So whose anti-Christian bias are we talking about? Are we saying that anyone who proclaims that heaven is divided into three separate and distinct levels, is that an anti-Christian bias? Because that's what Mormons believe. Mormons believe heaven has three levels, the A-lestial, the B-lestial, and the C-lestial. No, that's not it. it's telestial, terrestrial, and celestial, for those of you following from the Jell-O Belt out there. I know my Mormon theology. So whose anti-Christian bias? Which anti-Christian bias are we talking about? Interesting to see how that's going to work out. In local news, I was in town, the nearest town to my undisclosed mountain hideaway here in the state of Jefferson is Grants Pass, Oregon. You may recognize the name Grants Pass from their Supreme Court decision that allows cities now to punish people without homes, even if they have no place else to go. That's right. That's the Grants Pass that sued to be able to better mistreat homeless people. Well, Grants Pass is in the news here. The Daily Courier is the newspaper, and the headline says, Grants Pass loses $50 million grant for water plant as FEMA program is killed. Dismantling by Trump officials also will cost Jackson County $34.8 million for water projects. Just to give you some of the geography, the lay of land here, Grants Pass is in Josephine County, and to the, I guess it's east of Josephine County is Jackson County. That's where Medford and Ashland are. Both of these counties are the southernmost part of Oregon on the I-5 corridor. So Grants Pass is the city for Josephine, and Medford's the city for Jackson. The two most populous counties, by the way, in this southern Oregon area. So just reading from the story here, the Trump administration has canceled a FEMA program that was poised to award $50 million to help Grants Pass build a new water treatment plant and $34.8 million for water infrastructure projects in Jackson County, saying the move is part of efforts to eliminate fraud, waste, and abuse. So, between the two counties here in Southern Oregon, almost $75 million in grant programs for better water treatment, for cleaner water, so we don't have all sorts of bugs and parasites in our water, killed by the Doge boys. Now, I bet you're wondering, how did Grants Pass vote in the last election? Well. Josephine County went 63% for Donald Trump. Jackson County went 55% for Donald Trump. So congratulations, Jackson and Josephine County. You are the latest winners of Fuck Around and Find Out. Today we have to open the Boycott Idaho segment with the unfortunate news from yesterday, as Victor Perez, the 17-year-old autistic boy who was having a mental health episode and waving a knife around in his yard, he was gunned down by four Pocatello police officers who, within 12 seconds of showing up, had lined up in firing squad position to execute this young man when he lunged at them from behind a chain link fence. The boy was on the ground. He was near enough to no one to be able to hurt them, neither the police nor the family that were trying to help him. And when he got up off the ground, the boy, who suffers from cerebral palsy, so he's not exactly Mr. Dexterity, not exactly Mr. Athletic, got up and moved toward the cops, he still would have had to travel another 10 feet to reach the fence, which was a 4-foot-tall fence that he would have then had to scale over or leap over to even have a chance to wave his knife at 4 police officers who had tasers on them and who were wearing body armor, who couldn't have been bothered to just back the fuck up or surround the kid and tackle him. They opened fire on the kid. Since that moment, he'd been in a coma in the hospital, on ventilators, feeding machines. They had to amputate his leg. There was no way to save his leg. And on Sunday, after receiving word from the physicians that there was no brain activity, that Victor Perez was not there anymore, the family made the heart-wrenching decision to pull the plug. And Victor Perez died in that Pocatello hospital. And if we don't see some justice for Victor Perez, if these Pocatello cops are not brought up on charges, then we've certainly gone off the deep end here. They did not exercise one bit of care about this young man's life. On the 911 call, they were told there was a drunk out in the yard waving a knife at people. Because the neighbors who called in, they don't know the kid's got cerebral palsy. They just see him kind of stumbling around, and you'd think that was someone who's drunk. And they also mentioned on the 911 call that they couldn't understand what was going on because everyone was speaking Spanish. So that's what you had in those cops' minds. Drunk Mexican with a knife. And they summarily executed him. 17 years old. Victor Perez, may your memory be a blessing. May you rest in power. Now, other stories coming out of Idaho to tell you about today. A state judge has actually loosened Idaho's strictest in the nation abortion ban. In Idaho, you are only allowed to get an abortion in the cases of rape, incest, or the imminent threat to the life of the mother. Now, we've talked about in the past why the rape and incest exceptions are bullshit. Because in order to get the abortion in those rape and incest cases, you first must report the rape to the police. And then the police, in order to verify that you'd been raped, have to do a rape kit. And in Idaho, if you are a minor, you can have no medical procedures done on you without parental permission. Excuse me. So, if daddy rapes his daughter and gets her pregnant, daughter must report rape by daddy to the police, and daughter must get daddy's permission to administer that rape kit that proves he committed incest so she can get the abortion. You think that's going to happen? You think that's going to happen? Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Give her the rape kit. Prove that I raped her. Go ahead. So the rape and incest exceptions are nothing. But there is that life of the mother, the imminent life of the mother. Well, the problem with that in Idaho is that it had required that the woman's death be imminent and assured. Like, the doctor has to say, in their medical opinion, I guarantee if I do not do this abortion right now, she will die. Well, that leads to having women who are miscarrying or hemorrhaging, but not at death's door. Oh, she wouldn't die right now. She hasn't lost quite enough blood yet. Let's just let her sit in the parking lot for another 20 minutes while she bleeds out so we can get her close enough to death's door to give her an abortion. That's what the life of the mother exception has been in the state of Idaho. Well, no longer. A judge, a state judge, has ruled that the abortion exception in Idaho law is okay, even if the death of the mother is, quote, neither imminent nor assured, so long as the medical professionals are making a good faith medical effort, good faith medical decision in providing the abortion to save her life. Oh, gosh, what a relief. Now some women might only have to be severely harmed to get their abortion. They don't have to be at death's door. Oh, that's such good news. We'll take the little victories where we can get them. And one other bit of Idaho news coming at you here is that Idaho has decided, the Republicans in charge of the legislature there on the House and Senate side, have decided to form their own Idaho DOGE task force to root out fraud, waste, and abuse. Now, they tried to make a law for this. They had a law, they had a bill proposed this year in the legislature. They just never got around to it, this law that would form the DOGE committee. Well, when is that ever going to stop Republicans? There's no law? Well, hell, we'll just do it anyway. And that's what they're doing. They said, oh, we didn't get around to passing the law, but we're going to make the task force anyway. And we're going to start investigating fraud, waste, and abuse in Idaho. Well, I have a few ideas gleaned from some of the commenters on the news stories here as to where we could find fraud, waste, and abuse in Idaho. First of all, how about the state, I don't know if he's a representative or a senator, but one of the elected officials of the state was a fellow by the name of Mike Moyle. Now, Mike Moyle had a girlfriend who was also a legislator. She was living with him in his home in Star, Idaho, which is in Ada County on the southwestern side of the state, but she was a representative for one of the towns on the southeastern side of the state. And while she was living with her boyfriend in the legislature, who gets per diem, she was taking per diem as well. This per diem is to pay for all of her expenses to go back and forth to her eastern Idaho home that she wasn't living in. She was living with her boyfriend, the other legislator. So how about we claw back some of that per diem that was wasted through fraud and abuse by Mike Moyle's girlfriend? How about that? Or, I know, how about we claw back some of the $60 million the state of Idaho funnels to private religious schools? Yeah, well, how about some separation of church and state? We could claw some of that money back. Take care of that fraud, waste, and abuse. Or here's another idea. Take a page out of Nebraska's book and make Idaho a unicameral legislature. Idaho, this has always bothered me about Idaho, okay? So Idaho is a bicameral legislature like most state legislatures and our United States Congress. There's a House and there's a Senate. Now, on the national scene, House and Senate makes sense. Because one, the House, is the House of the people. The representatives in the House of Representatives are determined by population in their districts, and we get more representatives from, say, California, there's like 53 of them, than we get from Wyoming, there's one. So the House has its function as being the voice of the people because it's proportionally allocated based on the population. The Senate, on the other hand, is two senators per state. So the House is the House of the people, and the Senate is the House of the states, in a sense, because each state gets equal say. In the House, each person gets equal say. In the Senate, each state gets equal say. So there you've got two different legislative bodies representing two different points of view. But not in Idaho. In Idaho, they do have a House and a Senate, right? And then they have all these districts throughout the state, 35 legislative districts, right? In the House, each legislative district sends two representatives. In the Senate, each legislative district sends one senator. So what's the difference? They're representing the same groups. Two people from District 1 in one body one person from District 1 in the other body. There's no difference. One is not proportional to, say, the size of the counties and the other one's proportional to each county. No, they're the same representation. So let's scrap it. Why have an Idaho House and an Idaho Senate? Just have an Idaho House. Just have one body. Anyway, you could save a whole ton of money on that, I'm sure. And Lord knows, the state of Idaho really needs to get serious about cutting out fraud, waste, and abuse. Why? The state only had a $52.5 million surplus last year. $52.5 million surplus, which is leading the state to return, because of a law they have, whenever they have a surplus, they have to return that in the form of tax reductions in property tax. They're set to give $76.5 million in property tax reductions thanks to this $52.5 million surplus. I don't know why that math works out, but ask Idaho. So where's this fraud, waste, and abuse that's the problem? Are we trying to say we'd have more than $52.5 million if we, well, I guess if we get rid of that $60 million for religious schools, there's another, making $112 million, right? Idaho. Boycott the handmade state. With Steve Multishirt Bannon appearing on Bill Please Don't Disappear Me Dear Leader Maher's show, boldly predicting that Donald Trump will run for and be elected to a third unconstitutional term, I'm reminded of a horrible revelation I made back in February when I recoiled at the photo of Joe, no, seriously, he's a fascist, Biden, welcoming seriously the fascist into the Oval Office for a photo. And it made me wonder, when was the last time there was a Democratic president handing over the Oval Office to a Democratic president-elect? Now, in my lifetime, it's pretty easy to recall the last time a Republican president handed off the Oval Office to a Republican president-elect. It was Ronald Reagan, completing 8 years of rule and then turning it over to his vice president, George H.W. Bush, to rule for another four. 12 years of unbroken Republican rule. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized there has never been a dozen years, three straight terms, of Democratic presidents in my lifetime. 2 terms of Bill Clinton were supposed to be handed over to Vice President Al Gore, at least according to everyone but 5 members of the Supreme Court. And 2 terms of Barack Obama were supposed to be handed over to Hillary Clinton, at least according to 3 million more popular votes. And it's not to say that there haven't been Democratic presidents who follow Democratic presidents. Lyndon B. Johnson followed John F. Kennedy. Harry S. Truman followed Franklin D. Roosevelt. But in both of those cases, a Democratic president did not hand over power to a Democratic president-elect. Rather, the Grim Reaper handed power over to a Democratic vice president, who then failed to hand over power to another Democrat. So why can't a sitting Democratic president generate the momentum to get the next Democrat elected? The five-term span between Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was elected 4 times, but he died early in his 4th term, and Harry S. Truman, who served the remainder of FDR's 4th term, plus got elected to his own full term, that 5-term span is the only period since the Civil War when Democrats have kept the Oval Office for a dozen years or more. That 20-year span rescued us from the Great Depression, created the New Deal social safety net, won us World War II, set the dollar as the global reserve currency, began the process of integrating the United States, and establish the global Pax Americana. You know, everything Trump has taken 80 days to destroy. Democrats had so successfully transformed the country that the 22nd Amendment was quickly ratified to ensure we could never have a 3-term president again. Until, of course, the Supreme Court finds a way to wriggle Trump out of the 22nd Amendment. To find a living Democratic president, handing over the Oval Office to his elected Democratic successor, we have to go all the way back to the two presidents right before the Civil War. Franklin Pierce, elected in 1852, served one term and was followed by James Buchanan, elected in 1856. Two of the presidents who were considered, well, before Trump 1 and Trump 2, to be two of the worst presidents to ever serve. Two presidents whose failed leadership hastened the beginning of the Civil War. Still, that's just 8 straight years of Democratic presidents. To find 12 straight years of unbroken Democratic leadership, we have to go all the way back to the 7th president, two-term Andrew Jackson, elected in 1828, who was succeeded by one-term Martin Van Buren, elected in 1836. And Republicans didn't even exist back then. The Democrats were winning these elections against the Whigs. In other words, aside from Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Republican Party has never lost 3 presidential elections in a row. In fact, the Republicans have been quite good at stringing together terms. Before the 12 years of Reagan-Bush, there was a 12-year span of 1920 to 1932, right before Franklin Roosevelt, with Republican presidents Harding, who was elected in 1920 and died in office, Coolidge, who assumed office in 1923 and was elected in 1924, and Hoover, who was elected in 1928. There was also a 16-year span from 1896 to 1912 with Republican presidents McKinley, who was elected in 1896, re-elected in 1900, and then assassinated, Teddy Roosevelt, who took over in 1901 and then was elected in 1904, and William Howard Taft, who was elected in 1908. And there is another 16-year span of 1868 through 1884 with Republican presidents Grant, who was elected in 68 and 72, Hayes, elected in 1876, Garfield, who was elected in 1880 and then assassinated, and Chester Arthur, who assumed office after the assassination in 1881. So twice the Republicans have put together 3 straight terms, and twice the Republicans have put together 4 straight terms. And yet the only time Democrats have put together 3 straight terms was with one man, Franklin Roosevelt. So yes, it's absolutely critical that the Democrats win the 2028 presidential election, but let's hope that for the first time in 200 years, they go on to win the next 2 elections after that. Because it's going to take a dozen years or more of unbroken Democratic rule to fix everything that King Felon I will have destroyed by then. And another way to look at the inability of Democrats to maintain momentum from term to term is to take a look at the percentage of the electorate that selects the presidents every presidential election. I've talked about this on the show before, where did not vote wins the election over the Democrat or the Republican in every election since 1976, except for 2020. That's right. Every election since 1976, the proportion of the electorate who does not vote is a greater proportion than whoever voted for the Democrat and whoever voted for the Republican. And when you look deeper in these numbers, you find that the Democrats do not maintain their momentum. Bill Clinton was elected with 25% of the electorate. In the next election, he got 25% of the electorate. Barack Obama was elected with 33% of the electorate in his next election that had dropped to 30% of the electorate. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, in his first election, won 28% of the electorate. In his second election, raised that to 30% of the electorate, even though he lost to Joe Biden. And in 2024, raised that to 33% of the electorate. In every successive election, despite the well-documented lies and destruction of the country, despite being named by scholars as the worst president ever, despite being impeached twice, despite holding
banquets for sports stars filled with hamburgers, despite looking into an eclipse with his naked eyes, despite everything, Donald Trump's popularity among the electorate increased in each successive election. Why can't Democrats maintain momentum? It's the question I will continue to ask on this program until we finally see, sometime in my lifetime, three straight Democratic presidents. All right, folks, that's all the time we've got for the program today. And my apologies if you're hearing the logging helicopters in the background, the squealing dogs, or the crying children. It's been a lot of excitement here at Roller J Studios. The Radical Russ Show is produced, directed, researched, written, recited, posted, and catered by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons share-alike licensing. My main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and interstitial music is by freestockmusic.com and VTEMO, courtesy of freetouse.com/music. You can contact me by email at radicalrus@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUSS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as radicalrus.com and nowhere else. And now for your post-credits information, my post-credits scene, I guess. I was driving the other day, and I picked up this young lady. We got to talking. And somehow we got on the subject of Trump, and she remarked how these tariffs were such a terrible thing. She's got a boyfriend who's got a couple of businesses. One business does a lot of work, a lot of trade with Mexico. The other business does a lot of trade with China, and all these tariffs are killing her boyfriend's business. Gonna go out of business, gonna lose his business because these Trump tariffs are so terrible. Of course, agreed with her. But as the discussion went on, she kind of talked about the election. She said, I just didn't know about that Kamala. They were both such bad choices. Just both bad choices. Really? Okay. So like the 34 times convicted felon, insurrectionist, twice impeached, sexually assaulting, defrauding scumbag was just as bad a choice as the former attorney general, former senator, former district attorney, former vice president. Yeah, they were both terrible, equally bad choices. God, it frustrates me so much how shallow most people are when it comes to politics and making their vote. To have thought that Donald Trump and Kamala Harris were equally bad shows a terrible, terrible lack of critical thinking skills. Oh, my God, are we ever going to survive this thing? We shall see. You can support this podcast financially by donating to @RadicalRuss on Venmo, RadRuss on Cash App, or via PayPal on my website at RadicalRuss.com. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care of each other.
You plant it, you grow it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it.